Welcome to the Film Experience, supporting Actress SmackDown 1944. This is our companion podcast, so by the time you listen to this, you will have read our brief thoughts on each of the nominated performances, but now we have the whole group together to discuss the films. So I want to welcome my panel. We have Lauren King.
I've been a film journalist for quite a long time. I write about other things as well, but film is my passion. I write for the Boston Globe and other publications, mostly features, but occasional reviews. I miss the old films. I love covering current films, but you look at a year like this, and it just makes me wish I was going to the movies in the 40s.
Welcome, Lauren. And then we have Matthew Redman.
Hi. I'm a blogger at boyculture.com and at greaterdays.com. I'm an author. I wrote a book called Encyclopedia Madonica, and I've always been a huge film buff.
Which is evident in your site, as well as the Madonna stuff. There's old movie stuff.
I can't hide it.
And then we have Molly Pope, who's one of my favorite cabaret performers in the city, so I'm very excited to have her.
Hey, everybody. Yes, I'm mostly a singer, also a writer for solo performance kind of stuff, sometimes a musical theater actor, and generally, I don't want to say mired, but consumed by old-timiness, for lack of a better term, on all fronts, and grew up staying up all night watching TCM with my grandma, so it's very organically in my bones, this time period in entertainment.
Great. And then we have Mark Harris, who's been on the SmackDown before.
Hi, I'm a journalist and a film historian. I've written a couple of books, the most recent of which, Five Came Back, actually covers the period that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, and then we have, I'm very excited to welcome Farron Smith-Nemme, who I've been trying to get on the SmackDown forever, because you're sort of an expert in old movies.
Thank you. I've been writing at my blog called Self-Styled Siren since 2005, and my general area of love is pre-1960 film, so this is also very much up my alley. I've written for other places, including Film Comment, Sight and Sound, Criterion, and I wrote a novel about the search for a lost silent film called Missing Reels. So I'm really excited to cover this year, even Dragon Seed.
Okay, so I don't. Speaking of, we should probably get rid of that one right away. So. I don't know if you all saw the gift that I sent this morning, Gladys Cooper helping herself to multiple drinks as quick as she could. That's how I felt watching Dragonfeed.
Wow.
I saw it many years ago, and I made a good faith attempt to rewatch it this time, and I'm not sure what the hour mark was, but it's in addition to being bad, it's 148 minutes. It's an unconscionably long film. It's hard. There are so many different things wrong with it. I mean, the yellowface casting is merely the most glaring, but there were two directors because one of them got sick, and the script is a mess. So.
Yeah, it's so long that when they started making the movie, yellowface was okay, and by the time it was done, it wasn't. I had a hard time watching this one all the way through. Especially painful is that Katharine Hepburn is in it and is so bad in it. I think it was rough. It was rough going.
Yeah, I found myself really trying to find any redeeming quality about the film, even just to be like, okay, I didn't wait an hour or 148 minutes, and it just. I really can't come up with anything positive to take away other than perhaps look how far we've come, how far we still have to go.
It has some ambitions. It's a mess and it's not very good, but I think it had ambitions at least. It wasn't just a farcical attempt at depicting Chinese. It tried to
right.
be goal. It had some. I think there was some noble attempts at a story that.
Well, the strange thing about the noble attempt thing is that it does feel that way as you're watching it. That they mm-hmm. are trying to respect a different culture, but at the same time, it's just so racist, and you're like it's like a cognitive dissonance
I mean, historically, this was made at a time when American moviegoers were intensely sympathetic to the Chinese because the Japanese had attacked them, and the studios felt that there was a common enemy. So what makes this movie even more unbearable is, like, they were trying to be nice, and right. this is what they came up with. It's practically my job to sit there and watch some of these movies and say, well, this is of historical interest, you know, even if it's not aesthetically good. And this one just about broke me. I mean, I was so glad when Agnes Moorehead came on, just playing this, you know, evil, grasping woman in bad yellow face, because I thought at least she seems to know this is garbage, and that actually helped.
I know that the film has been defended on feminist grounds by Jeanine Basinger, because, you know, it is essentially the story of the education of a woman warrior, Katharine Hepburn, and it was absolutely loved by the Office of War Information, which was, you know, the people who were sort of, you know, guiding Hollywood on how to make patriotic movies that helped out our allies. But even at the time it was released, the critics really hated it. James Agee's review is hilarious. Variety hated it. The Times hated it. And it's a mystery to me how Aileen McMahon got this nomination. I don't, maybe Mark, as an Oscar historian, can enlighten us, but it just...
Well, it's sort of a mystery to me, too. I tried to remember that the supporting actor and actress categories were still very new in the year that we're talking about. They were only 7 or 8 years old. And it was still a situation where I believe extras were allowed to vote, and which is historically why Walter Brennan apparently kept winning all of these Best Supporting Actor Oscars in the first years of the category. So I thought maybe Aileen McMahon was... popular with extras, but it really is a mystery because it's her only nomination of her career, and the movie, it's not one of those weak performances that was dragged along because the movie itself got a lot of nominations. It didn't at all. So how it happened is really, really a mystery, especially since, as we saw, you know, even in the five movies that we all watched, there's no shortage of nominatable performances. I mean, that slot could easily have gone to, you know, for instance, Gladys Cooper in Since You Went Away. So, who knows?
What happens now? I mean, it snuck in there for whatever reason. It also got a cinematography nomination. It got two that year, so it's not like it was completely shunned.
It was a big MGM production, and I think, you know, like MGM tended to get its movies in, you know, somehow, you know, people voting to please the bosses or something, I guess, but...
Maybe instead of being like a weak performance that was dragged along by a great film, maybe it's the opposite, that she was kind of the least bad thing in it.
Yeah.
That is definitely what the reason I gave her two hearts. I did feel like she was one of its only semi-redeeming things, but even so, it's such a stock character. Farron, it was interesting to me to hear that you said it's been defended on feminist grounds, because, like, I actually found it equally offensive on gender grounds as racial grounds.
For what happens to Katharine Hepburn's arc, not McMahon's, but
right. Because,
you know,
McMahon has.
I think sometimes you can get nominated for being for sort of standing right next to a performance that doesn't work, so that you look better by contrast. And, you know, she's paired with Walter Huston, and I mean, Walter Huston was obviously a fantastic actor, but, like, you really do not by him on any level at all. So, you know, it could be sort of exactly what you said, least bad, you know, the least bad performance in the movie.
Well, the curious thing to me about the yellow face, and I know we should move on from Dragon Sea, but is that they, is that other, like, nationalities and vaguely ethnically, vaguely ethnic looking people, like Katharine Hepburn's romantic partner, who was often cast as exotic, but I think he's Turkish, and the other guy who plays, like, the shop owner who sort of gets in good favor with the Japanese, he was also Turkish, I believe. So it's astounding that it was okay to have foreigners, but not okay to have actual Asians, except for in extra roles, because that was even more jarring to see actual Asians among the, you know, the cast all made up.
like they were saying, Chinese are people too, guys, but let's not get carried away.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or them holding actual Asian babies, which... Which made the racism even worse. It's like, you're stealing someone's baby. That's horrible. Well, I do want to say, I promised to bring up Meet Me in St. Louis, and one of the ways I got through the excruciating viewing of Dragon Seed was thinking that they're both obsessed with seasons of the year. So I kept I kept sort of charting in my mind where Meet Me in St. Louis would be based on, you know, spring, summer.
Meet me in Shanghai.
Meet me anywhere but within Dragon Seed.
Alright. Meet me in the lobby.
And speaking of the lobby intermission, since you went away, that was a long one, but it reminded me of the a movie I really, really love, which is much better, but The Best Years of Our Lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Not as successful as that one, but
I thought was interesting about Since You Went Away was I'm not sure I've ever seen this at the beginning of a movie, but you know, the film is written by David O. Selznick, and the front credit literally says written by the producer. And I thought in some ways that is a very instructive credit as to why this is not the movie that The Best Years of Our Lives is, that it's kind of The Best Years of Our Lives as made by a very good producer as opposed to a movie made by a very good director. You know, it doesn't have, it's earnest, it's incredibly polished, it's well cast, it doesn't have this big first-hand vision of what this experience was that Wyler, you know, brought to his movie.
Yeah, I think that's totally true, and you can see that in the fact that Wyler's movie is just even more stuffed, maybe, with characters, but they all of the arcs read completely, where in Since You Went Away, I kept going, whose movie is this? And I'm okay with movies that have more than one lead, but it seemed like if we were talking about Jennifer Jones, then Claudette Colbert disappeared, and vice versa. Like, it had a hard time sort of navigating all the people within the movie.
I had a hard time with the fact that she was struggling for money with the husband being away at war, and there was no indication in any realistic terms of money problem at all. Except for letting the maid go. They lived in this opulent house. They had beautiful clothes. Whereas Best Years of Our Lives is very realistic. I mean, even in Hollywood terms, it's still very realistic. It feels grittier. This definitely felt a little too polished, but still, in the conventions of the melodrama, I thought it was a good example of it.
I can give a little, background about the propaganda aspect of the movie, in that shortly after Pearl Harbor, the Office of War Information couldn't literally tell Hollywood what to put in movies, but they did create a list of suggestions saying there are, and this is open, it wasn't a secret, it was published in newspapers, it was saying, you know, there are 6 points that we would really like Hollywood movies to make about the war. And, you know, things like preparedness and, the importance of unifying to, fight, the enemy, but one of them was the strength of the home front.
Yeah.
And, you know, since this movie says right up front, it's about, I think the phrase is, that unconquerable fortress, the American home.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I think what you're talking about, where it's like you never quite know whose movie it is, I think that problem emerges out of that, in that, like, the main character is that unconquerable fortress, the American home, and who's in it becomes a little blurry at points. I mean, yeah, sometimes it is Claudette Colbert's story, sometimes it's Jennifer Jones's, you know, it's less interested in the individual characters than is healthy for a movie to be. It's really a movie about making its point, and about, like, hitting as many sub-points about home front unity and preparedness. I mean, the whole way in which, you know, Hattie McDaniel's character sticks by them is very much like a propaganda point about sacrifice and how, you know, everyone has to kind of give something up. Of course, the person who has to give something up in this movie is, like, the person who has the least. But you know, all the intention in this movie is very specifically, you know, to help sell the war at a time when audiences were beginning to get a little sick of it in real life and in the movies.
Yeah.
It's the kind of movie that I know I won't, you know, after having seen it, I thought it was very beautiful. I thought it was great, very emo. I mean, watching Jennifer Jones, you know, mature before our eyes was quite interesting. I can see why she was singled out. Although I was thinking, like, wow, Agnes Moorehead, here she is again. Really much better in this than in Dragon Teeth. But, you know, in the end, it was just hard for me to totally connect to it, because it did feel so distracted by, you know, getting that propaganda out to us. So I was very aware of it as I was watching. So I only got carried away with it pretty much whenever Jennifer Jones did her thing. I was much more invested in the movie than just kind of watching it as a propaganda piece.
But yeah. She has two of the most memorable scenes in the movie: the dance at the hangar, and then the train station, which is just, I mean, it's a perfect 1944 movie moment. It's so beautifully filmed. It's so wonderfully acted. And then you reflect on the drama that was going on behind the scenes, where, you know, David O. Selznick was in the process of, if he had not completed the process of stealing Jennifer Jones away from Robert Walker, who was playing opposite her in this movie. And you can also kind of feel in the movie, I mean, so, somebody talked about how the fact that she was nominated in this category is basically category fraud. I think it was Nathaniel. You can feel, like, Selznick, you know, like, pulling the movie to give us more Jennifer, you know, at the start of the Jennifer Jones obsession that was going to consume basically the rest of his life. But when she's good, she's so good. I could watch that train scene a million times, and it will get me every time.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I described it as like a sort of operatic clarity of feeling, because the thing I like about her acting style, which I do think is dated, is that even though you don't ever have two emotions at once, which one of you mentioned, I forget, I apologize.
Yeah, that was me.
Okay. Even though there's not as much subtext in that acting style, you do get these, like, really big, like, pure feeling moments that really work in the context of like, this type of movie. And I was thinking about that a lot with Molly. I was laughing at your comment about the gazing into the middle distance.
Well, I mean, one of the things I enjoyed so much about revisiting these films is, how, you know, I mean, we all know this, but, you know, they're sort of restating in this context how much happens on their faces. You know, we didn't need words, we had faces, if you will. And Jennifer Jones' face is just, I mean, the way it picks up the light is a phenomena in and of itself. And then, she, you know, in her moments of reflection, she mastered gazing into the middle distance, and you can just watch her internal life with her just sitting there.
Yeah, wasn't it Ingrid Bergman who had talked about, maybe Farron, maybe you'll know this, that she had to, for big close-ups, like, to empty out your face? And then people project whatever they feel onto you?
I don't know. I know that at the famous end shot of Queen Christina, Reuben Mamoulian famously told Greta Garbo to think about nothing. And so you look at that incredible close up and you can project, like, you know, just the sorrows of the world on it. Mm-hmm.
It is funny though to watch that beautifully filmed train scene, which is all about, like, loyalty and waiting and pining and I will be here for you, and think, you know, as you said, that meanwhile David O. Selznick is demolishing what's left of Jennifer Jones's marriage to Robert Walker, who was on that train, and you think, like, wow, maybe the American home is conquerable, you know?
By Selznick.
I think Robert Walker was already doing that, wasn't he supposedly seeing Judy Garland at the time?
Right. Like, there were much more interesting movies to be made then.
Yeah. He was such a good actor. I mean, it's sad that
he was
never recognized with an Oscar. I mean, he was terrific. So many great movies he made. Just watching him in that context of talking about Oscar nominations, you know, that he never got anything. And he's done everything from The Cloth to, I mean, just so many great performances.
Yeah, I mean, I always think of him, of course, from Strangers on a Train.
Yeah.
So it was a little bit jarring to see him in this context where he's so sweet.
That's what I mean, the range and the lovely film he made with Judy Garland, Bach, was just, I mean, it's so, I just think he's kind of an unsung actor of that era.
Yeah, I agree. I appreciated seeing him in this movie. And I also really appreciated Agnes Moorehead and Hattie McDaniel, because,
yeah,
you know, obviously they came at it really differently, and Hattie McDaniel had fewer opportunities than Agnes Moorehead. But both of them are handed roles in Since You Went Away that are kind of like, here, do this. Do this thing that you always do. And instead, they don't do this thing that they always do. They do this thing that they always do with, like, incredible feeling and conviction. And, you know, Agnes Moorehead has to play this, like, this bitch, this town snob, and you know, get told off in this big way by Jennifer Jones, which is, like, just what you've been waiting for, I guess, if you're a 1944 audience member. But she's just, like, she's such an unlazy actress, you know. She just completely nails it, and I mean, I so enjoyed watching her in all of these movies, because she just always seems to be having a good time, even when she gets, like, the worst assignment.
I have to ask Molly, since you are an actor, do you feel that when you're watching these things, like, where the actors are interested or not interested in their roles when you watch something like this?
I think so. I think you can tell. I mean, sometimes it's more how much do they, their personas just sort of disappear, which, you know, I would like to say a little bit about when we get to Ethel Barrymore. But, yeah, I think you can definitely tell when an actor is really enjoying themselves and really not enjoying themselves. And Agnes Moorehead, for the most part, just seems to find a way to enjoy herself every single time.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true in all three of the movies we saw that she was in. Like, she doesn't even, yeah, like, I think, Mark, you said that Agnes knows Dragonseed is trash, so even there she's, like, hamming it up, but not in as, like, deep a way as she usually can be, like, entertaining.
Right.
Well, when we're speaking of, like, lack of Oscar recognition, I think that's a good time to move over to Cary Grant. Because none but the Lonely Heart, I was intrigued, Farron, by your description that you said the movie's for people who find him suspicious.
I, you know, it, it, he, I, this was one of his personal favorites, I think, because it stretched him, right? This is not his typical character at all, and it's been remarked on many times that, you know, this guy is closer to his Archie Leach, you know, like, reality growing up. As you know, he did not come from a pampered background. He was from Bristol. He wasn't a Cockney, but this is much closer than just about anything else he ever did. But at the same time, I find it a really dour movie. It's hard for me to get into. I think part of it is that Odets is directing. He achieves like nice moments, but he doesn't have the sense of pacing that a real director has. And I don't want to use the word boring, but it's not terribly engaging to me. It gets praised a lot though by people who, you know, seem really impressed by Grant's kind of persona switch in this movie, which I guess is what I was referring to. I take it for granted that he could do anything if he wanted, you know, but.
This is not the movie I would use as in talking about him not ever having gotten an Oscar. This isn't the one I would bring up just because my take on it was I never believed him at all in this movie. And it was really difficult to stick with the whole thing because, as you said, it is really kind of a bummer. It is really a dour film, but he was at the core of it, and he was just so, I don't know, I just felt that the characterization was kind of glib, and I just never really believed him because he's Cary Grant, and he looks so, you know, like, why doesn't he just go become a model? You know,
he's also a bit old for the part too, but.
But I loved Barrymore in it. I was one of the people who was very much taken with her. And again, maybe I was clinging to her as the point of interest and something I didn't find interesting, but I really enjoyed her, how tough she was and how opaque for a very long time her character was. And then eventually it broke down a little bit and it was kind of an unsatisfying ending.
Well,
I agree with that. That's why I still think Barrymore deserved it in this category, because she becomes such a central, she has such central importance because he's a little weak, Cary Grant, like for some of the reasons everyone else said. So she becomes even more important in that she's so believable as the reason he does so much of what he does. And she holds the film together, I think.
One thing that's interesting.
This was the sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just saying, this was the performance of the five that I struggled the most with to figure out how I felt about it. It was strange to watch this movie, which I had not seen before, in the context of trying to assess this performance, because it's clear from her first scene that she's a real actress and that she's a serious actress. Her competence is not ever in question. But ultimately for me, I think why I rated the performance lower than a lot of the rest of you is I never felt like I could not suspend disbelief with her for a second. I just never forgot for some reason that she was sort of this great dame playing this little woman, and I guess ultimately I think she does certain things in the performance to keep reminding you of that. I mean, it just felt sort of very heavily drawn to me. Even her restraint felt noisy in a way that I like could not connect with. So I of all the five performances that we're talking about, I think this might be the one that I'm perhaps being unfair to, but I just couldn't find my way into it.
But I mean, I sort of took it almost the same way. I felt like she was a little too regal. The stuff that she was doing felt like very, like, kind of consciously thought out. And there was a vague sense that maybe she was slumming for me, you know, that in the sense of going, you know, like from being like the queen of Broadway to Hollywood. So.
The interesting thing about the write-ups on this one is I agreed with everyone, even though the write-ups are all over the place. And I think maybe that's what, Molly, I think maybe you felt similarly, because we both loved the performance, but you were also noticing that she's playing a low-class
person. Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I would say I would agree with both Cary Grant and Ethel Barrymore always being conscious of, well, with Barrymore, that she is that great actress, and with Cary Grant, that he doesn't quite shed his Cary Grantness, even sort of at this point in his career. The thing that I really, really enjoyed, even though it's, you know, not the best, was the Clifford Odets script, because some of those scenes were just so Clifford Odets dynamics, and one of the first exchanges by the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier that was just so simple and landed so firmly. You know, I forget the character's name, he says, might be my son, and Cary Grant answers, might, and then Cary Grant says, might be my dad, and the other guy answers, might, and it's just that moment packed so much punch. And so I wonder about other scenes where I admittedly sort of started to get bored and my mind wandered, you know, if I was reading that on a page, what it would seem like, and how maybe in a different production with some different actors, more of the scenes would have come to life, because I do love Clifford Odets.
Mm-hmm. I think some of it is the like the notion of the era. I mean, it was a little bit more theatrical. I think Barrymore's performance, you could argue it's more theatrical. We're not at anywhere close to when the method acting took over. I mean, there is still some stiltedness in many, many of the performances in this at this time. That I think if you're a fan of these films, you just sort of overlook it and know there's some conventions of the era in the way people acted. It's not that realistic a lot of the time. It's gritty. There's realism in it, but there's still a little bit more manneredness to performances of this time.
No, I totally know what
definitely.
You're saying.
In this movie felt to me like I was watching a 30s movie. Like it felt. Like that stiltedness you're talking about, and then you compare it to something that came out the same year, like Double Indemnity, that was just so, still, to me, is still very fresh, and is so slick, and is so connected to what it's doing. There was, like, definitely a little bit of a reserve about this movie that didn't work for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great point, that even for its time, this was a little bit dated, and this acting style is a little bit dated, although, on the other hand, as far as Cary Grant is concerned, nothing is more contemporary in the Academy Awards than rewarding an actor for sort of glumly doing something other than the thing they're really good at. You know?
Yeah, because you can't make it look too effortless, which was his problem the whole time in terms of getting awards. But yeah, the idea of conventions of the era and how things become dated, that's what I was trying to get at with Jennifer Jones, but I also think the style of like omniscient narrators, which feels a little bit like books on tape about a lot of old movies, and None But the Lonely Heart and Dragonseed both use that. And I wonder sometimes what is going to be the convention of this era that we don't even realize is a convention, and then later people are like, oh, that movie was from 2017.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Gaslight feels much more modern, maybe because Ingrid Bergman's acting hasn't dated at all. She's so psychologically nuanced. I don't know. I feel like I'm babbling now, but it was something that came up.
I think if Gaslight feels modern, it's an accomplishment of the cast and the director, because that was an old play even at that point. You know, it had come out like in, you know, at least like 10 years before, I think. And run on Broadway for quite a long time. You know, plus it's a period piece, and there's, you know, nothing easier to make stiff.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone else mentioned Double Indemnity. That's a great example of something that, you know, it's film noir. It may be crime and suspense or thrillers are easier than drama, but I think it's just in the way it's conveyed, directed, written. For some reason, None But the Lonely Heart, for some reason, makes me think of completely different film, but A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. I think it was because of the poverty and the sort of, you know, ne'er-do-well who's trying to get himself out of poverty. But that, to me, is a movie, although very much of the time and hokey in many ways, to me, holds up beautifully. I can watch that film over and over. Not so much None But the Lonely Heart, despite the fact that I think Barrymore is terrific in it.
This was the moment not just of Billy Wilder, but of Preston Sturges. So it was very possible to give, like, lively, contemporary, energetic, you know, loose performances, this kind of restrictive great lady of the stage style. It's not just ascribable to 1944, because other people were doing some really interesting stuff then.
Mm-hmm. Well, we still even get that sort of when someone knows they're a star or that they have that sort of bearing. I mean, we even get that now still. The great lady deigns to give this performance. You know, we get a little bit of that still in current cinema. You know,
yeah,
whether it's Cate Blanchett or, you know, that sort of actor.
Yeah, it's also, too, when I was looking at these films, I was trying to look at it, if you were a voter in 1944, who you might have responded to, rather than always looking in retrospect. And I think if when this film came along, I mean, I think it would have been a sort of, oh, what's this? Like, it has something different than many of the others of that time. Not so much, say, Double Indemnity, but as a drama, as a, you know, kitchen sink type drama. It did stand out a little bit. Maybe it looks dated now, but I don't think it's, maybe not. Maybe it did feel dated even then. But I think it would have stood out a little bit more at the time.
I was interested to see that Barrymore got, I hadn't remembered this, she got 4 Best Supporting Actress nominations in like a 6 or 7 year stretch, and this was the first of them. So
Yeah. Clearly
what she did was really resonant with people in Hollywood. I mean, they obviously loved her, and I realized watching this, I looked up the other performances, I just happened not to have seen her, I think, in any of her nominated performances. So I did wonder watching it, like, if I had more context for her acting, whether I might have judged this performance differently or not. And it made me curious to see what the films she did when she got a little more used to camera acting were like.
The only one of those that I've seen of her past of the 4 nominations other than None But the Lonely Heart was The Spiral Staircase. And I don't know if any of you have seen that, but I think she's in bed the whole time from the performance, if I remember.
Yeah, she's quite good in The Spiral Staircase. You know, the one that I like am not that familiar with is Pinky, but she's really quite wonderful in the Paradine Case, which is a really like brief part, but she plays Charles Lawton's obviously like psychologically if not physically abused wife, and she conveys it quite well. I mean, I do think that she got the hang of camera acting, you know, more so later on. I also like her in Portrait of Jenny, which I don't think she was nominated for, but
no. Not for that one. But she also won the, I mean, I'm sure we all respect the National Board of Review. but she also won that for None But the Lonely Heart. But I feel like we're avoiding, like, the topic of Gaslight, which was the best movie we watched.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it's like a long chalk.
Now, had everyone seen Gaslight before?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I am embarrassed to admit that I had not seen it before. So I don't know how that happened. But
it happened.
Yeah, but especially because I love Ingrid Bergman, and, you know, so you'd think it would be something that I had seen, but for whatever reason.
No, Nathaniel. Nathaniel, remember, you've seen it. We had a conversation about it.
And anyway, I just was thrilled by it from start to finish. I loved it. You know, we were focused on Angela Lansbury for this, but her part is very small, but really Ingrid Bergman is such a magnificent movie star every time. I was just totally with this movie.
I don't want us to neglect Charles Boyer either, because I think it's one of the best things he ever did in Hollywood. He's so sinister, and by the end of that movie you hate him so much. I recommended this to a friend one time, and they called me up after and they were like, I cannot believe how much I hated Charles Boyer. Meaning the character, not the performance. And a lot of Lansbury's best scenes are with him, where she's, you know, like flirting with him. I saw an interview with her where she was discussing this part, and she referred to the character as a slut. And said that she discussed with George Cukor, you know, like how she was going to kind of get into Boyer's personal space. And you know, like, make it obvious that she was flirting with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, it reads, for sure. I did find it interesting that Charles Boyer had gotten a special Oscar just a couple years before this for establishing the French Research Foundation in Los Angeles. Anyway, but I was wondering, like, maybe that, you know, he was obviously popular before that because he'd been nominated a couple times, but I do think it's interesting, it plays into, you know, this big French star, and, you know, there are allies, and this is wartime, so he was very popular, and I know that it's interesting with old stars that certain countries were downplayed for if you were from there, or they pretended you weren't from there, like Louise Renier.
Yeah.
In that time frame, maybe I'm just focused on World War II because Mark's with us.
I mean, this to me, in the context of World War II, felt like just great escape. It probably for audiences, like all of those people in the movie, Lansbury, Bergman, Boyer, fell under the general category of European, you know, which was a kind of permission slip to go escape into, like, this sophisticated, fun, wicked, old melodrama. And, I mean, I hadn't seen it in a really long time, and I was blown away. I loved the movie, and I was blown away by Lansbury because she's a teenager, and she's in this movie with two truly formidable actors in what is a minor part, and she just seems to, like, bring a whole life for that character and energy for that character into the movie with her. Like, you want to know her deal. It's like you when she's on screen, you just watch her. You really think, well, you know, this who, what is this wicked, you know, insinuating girl up to? And, you know, to be a teenager and to be on screen with Ingrid Bergman or Boyer, and to be the one that audiences are watching, it's just an incredible, like, I can't imagine how we would react right now seeing an 18-year-old, you know, blow onto the screen like that and just, you know, completely handle it.
Yeah. I was astonished to see on Nathaniel's like write up how short her screen time is, like just over 10 minutes. I was like, you're kidding me. I feel like she's all over that movie, but she isn't.
Yeah, they just use her for flavor. They just pepper her in once in a while.
Well, I mean, to Mark's point, when I was a kid and I would watch old movies, I would always be very captivated by anything that seemed suggestive, because in my head, anything old, those were the old days, you weren't allowed to be racy, and then I'd come upon some pre-code movie and just be shocked. But this was also like that, in that her knowingness, the knowingness of that character is shocking. It's almost obscene, you know, just watching her face and her eyes. And also another point about how modern this movie feels, I wonder if there's a little bit of it is that just knowing that this is a familiar person to us and that she's still alive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's crazy to think that this movie came out 73 years ago and she's still alive and very recently was still acting, and you can kind of trace her, you know, from this ingenue, you know, this young role all the way through, you know, recent stuff and the variety of things she's done. There's also that going on in, at least in my head while I'm watching the movie, playing through her career and like all the changes she's had. And it makes it even more impressive that she was this good, this young.
Yeah. I liked what, Farron, what you said about like you think maybe she's capable of being evil, but maybe it's just selfishness. which I think what Mark was alluding to too, like, is she part of the plot? Because she does play it like, you get a real sense of, I mean, all of you mentioned this, you get a really sense of who Nancy is, but also who Nancy might be, which is like a trick to pull off for
sure,
a movie.
I think she seems like an opportunist who knows she's an opportunist and has no problem with the fact that she's an opportunist. And I think that's part of what leaves her open to, she would probably be complicit if she thought that would serve her. You don't get a sense that she has a strong sense of morality.
Right, exactly.
Survival.
Yeah.
And, you know, if one way we're measuring, like, what a great actress is what do they bring to the part that isn't necessarily in the lines or on the page, with Angela Lansbury, even this early, you feel like she's got six different things going on in her head about who this girl is and what she wants out of life and how she's going to get it and where she comes from and what this job means and doesn't mean to her. It's just like there's a really full person there on screen, and it's a jolt, you know. It's a good jolt.
Yeah, the only time, like you said, you know, if you saw somebody come on that fully formed, the only time I remember that happening in my lifetime, and unfortunately I don't think the career totally bore it out, but was Juliette Lewis in Cape Fear.
Huh.
Because I remember she just sort of like blew Robert De Niro off the screen in their big scene together, and I was like, what? And the same thing happened with the Oscar nomination. But it does happen occasionally, but it's rare that it happens with this much force and that there's a huge career after it.
Right, Jodie Foster, I guess, is someone I'd point to. It's like, oh, you're a fully formed person from the time we saw you.
Yeah.
Isn't that one of the hallmarks of the supporting categories? That's why we all love them so much, is that they make the most of in sometimes pretty small parts.
Yeah.
I mean, we just said with Agnes Moorehead, the same thing. And when you see them over and over in a lot of these older films, when character actors and actresses were just so terrific, because that's what they did. They were the character actors, and they just made the most of them, and you end up being more riveted by their performances sometimes than the leading ones.
Mm-hmm. I had trouble evaluating Agnes Moorehead because I trying to pull apart what she was doing versus what the script was. Because Mrs. Parkington is like such a strange... I don't even know how to discuss Mrs. Parkington, but I kept going back and forth between, like, is she amazing because of the implications that the script isn't discussing, or is she giving the implications? Or, because I really liked her in it, but I always felt like the character should have been even bigger, or not bigger, but more, that felt like there was a lot they could have explored with it that they didn't.
Agnes Moorehead, she's good. She's as good as you'd expect her to be. To me, that was... She's almost better in Since You Went Away, but...
Oh, I think she is. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I feel like she's sinking her teeth into Since You Went Away more than she is the Mrs. Parkington.
Yeah.
You know, because there's so much that's hinted at in the plot, and you never get to see... It feels like she's not given a chance to do anything with the character, even though the plot suggests there's a lot she could do with it.
Yeah.
It's very much a Greer Garson vehicle, with all that implies. And I feel like, it's, that fact is kind of sucking up a lot of the oxygen.
Well, yeah, she even gets
As she always does. I mean, I feel like I'm still in mourning for the movie that I was hoping this was going to be, which was, I would just happily have waited downstairs for 2 hours with Gladys Cooper, watching her, you know, sneak mints and drinks and be mean to children and sort of spit acid from her chair. Like, she was so amazing and kind of wicked and delightful. And then Greer Garson comes on and we flash back and it's like, oh, here we go, the Greer Garson and Walter Pidgeon show. And, you know, I'm a huge defender of Mrs. Miniver. This was their fourth of eight teamings, and I just, you know, she is, to me, consistently the least surprising of all actresses of that era, and she sucks the surprise out of any movie she's in.
I will also defend Random Harvest to the death, but overall, I have to agree. She's it's interesting because I went back to my my autobiography of Tay Garnett, the director, and he talks about how early on in the filming he told Greer Garson, you know, that she was being too great lady-ish. And, you know, and he talks about kidding her out of that, you know, and like a signal that he had to just tell her that she's being too, like, sort of stuck up. And the interesting thing is that, like, I mean, I don't know that he succeeded all that well, but, I mean, she still feels a little too grand for the part, but, Moorhead, on the other hand, draws the best out of Garson, I would say.
Yeah, and I would say, based on everything you're saying, we know that Greer Garson voted for Miss Ethel Barrymore. The great ladies of the stage and, or of the stage and screen, yes. But aside from these movies, I want to hear favorites of 1944.
Meet Me in St. Louis, hands down, was one of the best of that year.
Yeah, one of the best of the 40s in general, and the Oscars just kind of did they think it was a trifle? Like, I don't understand it.
I don't either. I'd like to hear what everyone thinks, because that is one of the great omissions of this year to me, in so many categories except the song, and even it didn't even win the song.
No, and Mary Astor, I would have voted her above all of these five we watched for best supporting actress.
She belongs there. Yeah, she would have been there. Yep.
I think musicals generally, until the 60s, got a little under-nominated by the Academy. They just, I don't really know why, but certainly the performances were underappreciated. Not enough of them made it into the main categories. You know, and I agree, it's a fantastic movie. I think my favorite from 1944 is honestly Double Indemnity. It's just a movie I can watch over and over and over again. And it was a movie that was certainly duly recognized in its day. But, God, everything about it, to me, holds up just impeccably. And it doesn't really have a supporting actress that we could... that I could make a case for sticking into this category, so it's not like it was robbed of anything in the context of what we're talking about, but it is my favorite.
Definitely, Double Indemnity is my favorite, you know, far and away. I just showed it to someone who was younger who's never seen it, and he's someone who doesn't want to see black and white movies and doesn't, you know, like old timey stuff, and he was riveted. He loved it. But I also really loved Lifeboat.
Great.
That's another one that's such an unusual movie from that year, and you know, thank God it gave us a wonderful performance by Tallulah Bankhead on the screen that we get to enjoy. So I like that one a lot.
I think Laura too is a great. It's not up there with Double Indemnity, but Laura is really good, I think.
Yeah, Laura is my personal favorite from 1944. I think the cast is so much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, yeah.
It's funny that
Clifton Webb is so good.
It's funny that Laura and Lifeboat came up because, you know, it's just a good reminder that, you know, when we were talking about Ethel Barrymore, you can be a really mannered actor and still give a fantastic performance, like Clifton Webb in Laura, like Tallulah Bankhead in Lifeboat. I mean, it's not as if naturalism is the only way to go. You know,
right, exactly.
So I think my issue with Ethel Barrymore was that she isn't a naturalistic actress necessarily, but she didn't find an interesting way to be mannered in this. She probably did a lot on stage or in her later movies, but yeah, some of these, you know, some of the performances we love the most are from this era are not at all kind of pre-Brando naturalism. They could be. I mean, Betty Davis can be one of the weirdest actresses on earth, and at the same time just be mind-blowingly great. So
I mean, I really love her in Mr. Skeffington, which is also from this year. And I mean, I guess I'm not an Oscar historian. I don't know that much about Oscars. But when I was going back over like what was nominated and what won, it almost broke my heart how many great movies were completely overlooked. You know, like The Lodger came out this year, The Uninvited came out this year, Curse of the Cat People, you know, and like passed over for things like Dragon Seed, which got two, and then there were several nominations for Wilson. I don't know if anybody's ever tried to watch Wilson.
Oh, God.
I mean, Wilson makes Dragon Seed look like Double Indemnity.
Oh, God.
I mean, it doesn't have the racial aspect, but it is such a block of wood, and I don't know. I mean, I have no explanation for why Meet Me in St. Louis didn't get like the something, you know, something more than a nomination for what the trolley song, you know. But you know, there was also I think Phantom Lady was this year. I mean, so many great movies that were just never anywhere near an Oscar. So I guess, you know, like, rather than naming one favorite, I would just urge people to, you know, try and explore it more in depth, because some of the more obscure movies like Charles Laughton in The Suspect or The Woman in the Window, they're, like, so much better than a lot of what was nominated.
Yeah, I think what comes into play here, and this is just part of it, is Oscar history in general, is the need for something to be important in subject matter, and that comes before what's important in execution,
right,
which when it really should be the opposite, because what tends to survive tends to be more on like how good is the actual movie, and people don't care about whether something's important if it's great.
that is changing a little bit, you know. There's more room for genre now, but there's absolutely, you know, there is a Wilson pretty much every year in the Best Picture roster.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
That was Zanuck's, thing. He was obsessed with Wilson. And he was even, you know, he was talking about Wilson years later that it didn't get the number of Oscars he wanted. So I'm sure he muscled those nominations through.
And there were reviews of Wilson at the time that were like, 50 years from now, people will still, you know, revere this benchmark movie. It's like, it didn't happen 5 years later. You know, people were like, what's Wilson?
It's like the that part has never gone away. Yeah, like you're saying, Mark, that never goes away. Like, great man biopics, like Oscar has loved them
right
since the beginning, and they still do.
Churchill this year. Get the Darkest Hour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But at least that one's fun to watch.
Well, at least, I mean, I agree that so many great films were overlooked this year, and one of the bright spots for me is how many actually did get nominated. I mean, it's unfortunate that Going My Way got Best Picture, but that happens every year. The weakest one is often the winner in Best Picture. Not lately, but that's been a trend. In this case, like Double Indemnity and Gaslight would have both been better choices than Going My Way.
Yeah.
It's just too bad that Going My Way is sort of the one that ended up.
Do you think? I was wondering, Mark. Do you think like Going My Way? Do you think it's like sort of ode to being a good person and a sort of moralistic thing was important, like,
that, you know, I
that
have,
plays into like, what was going on with the world.
I mean, people loved Priests, you know. I almost can't talk about that movie because I have, like, a critical blind spot about Bing Crosby. Like, I don't get it. I have never gotten it. And, you know, people like Gary Giddens have written, like, you know, his two-part biography of Bing Crosby is amazing. I do not understand him as an actor. So Going My Way is one of those, when I'm thinking about Oscar history, I just try to pass over it as quickly as possible.
Gaslight would have been a better choice. One thing that I just wanted to say about Gaslight before we left was that, you know, I mean, it's a word that we've seen so much this year. and it still has, a friend of mine, Imogen Smith, was moderating a discussion, a screening of it, you know, for an organization that deals with domestic abuse, and it's still very powerful in that way. So Gaslight, we're still watching, yeah, like 73 years later. Wilson, not so much.
I think this was 43 or 44 was the first year that Best Picture dropped from 10 nominees to 5.
Yeah, that's right. There's only 5.
Yeah, this was the year where it got, where it went to its permanent 5, but it didn't stay there. It went to its almost permanent 5, and now it's back up again.
Yeah. And which ones would have fleshed it out to 10 if it had still been a 10? Like,
oh God, Dragon Seed? Who knows? No, I'm just kidding.
Arctic and Old Lace? I mean, there's a bunch of them in there they could have tried. Well, that was the fun Cary Grant versus the Take Your Medicine, you know, movie.
But Take Your Medicine movies are important, and in 50 years people will watch them. So the theory goes each time.
I'm just going to make a kind of good joke. 50 years later, they'll at least talk about them on podcasts. Thank you very much.
And that's so true. And that's why it's important to be nominated, because then you have a historical asterisk by your name, even if your movie's terrible. Well, thank you so much. This was a great conversation. And we can thoroughly recommend Gaslight to all of you. The other movies, perhaps not so much. Once again, I want to thank my guests, Farron Nemi.
Thank you.
Mark Harris.
Thanks so much.
Molly Pope.
Thank you.
Matthew Redmond.
Thanks, it was a lot of fun.
And Lauren King.
Thank you, it was great. I had fun.
Molly, it just occurred to me we didn't discuss Judy Garland.
That's all right, we can do that on our own time.
I feel like so embarrassed that I'm such a missionary for Molly, but next time she does her A Star Is Born show at 54 Below, you guys all have to go. It's amazing.
Oh, I can't wait.
I would love to.
Yeah, the first time anyone's performed the entire score extant.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And I've seen it twice, and it's totally amazing. So, Molly, you really need to get another one scheduled at 54 Below.
I will. I have to do this musical about Robert Moses first, real quick.
Okay.